Oscar Wilde once quipped that now we sit through Shakespeare in order to recognize the quotations. Welcome to this fifth lecture in the Wyoming Catholic College Distance Learning course, The Classical Roots of American Liberty. This is Director of Distance Learning, Dr. Jim Tonkowicz. Abraham Lincoln did not sit through Shakespeare in order to recognize the quotations. Lincoln recognized all the quotations already. Lincoln was drawn to Shakespeare's words, to his themes, to his worldview. These had enormous influence over our 16th president throughout his political career. In this lecture, Wyoming Catholic College president Dr. Glenn Arbery explores Shakespeare's political legacy in America.
Shakespeare in the American political tradition, the case of Lincoln. Shakespeare has been part of the American imagination since the Pilgrims on the Mayflower first stepped ashore at Plymouth, Massachusetts back in 1620, or at least it would be gratifying to say so. Shakespeare died only 4 years earlier in 1616, and the grown men and women who came over on the Mayflower were the great playwright's exact contemporaries. If only one of the young Pilgrim girls had quoted Miranda as she stepped off the ship, "Oh, brave new world." But alas, she did not. The Pilgrims mightily disapproved of Christmas, much less theater. And it would be altogether surprising if they had heard of Master William Shakespeare of the shrewd, thriving business firm of Condell, Shakespeare & Company, proprietors of the Globe Theater in London, as Herman Melville describes his fellow Londoners, Shakespeare's fellow Londoners would have known. It would also be gratifying to be able to show that a century and a half later, Shakespeare decisively shaped the thought of the American founders in framing our Constitution. Many of the founding fathers certainly knew Shakespeare's plays. In fact, John Adams and Thomas Jefferson visited Stratford-upon-Avon together in 1786, a year before the Constitutional Convention. They were both kind of horrified at what they saw as the disrespect, you know, to the remains of Shakespeare's presence there. Adams was always a great reader of Shakespeare, and he later wrote to his son John Quincy Adams, who was also a great reader of Shakespeare, that the English history plays showed, quote, the treachery, perfidy, treason, murder, cruelty, sedition, and rebellions of rival and unbalanced factions. Certainly a problem addressed in the Federalist Papers. The tragedy Coriolanus, another play that Adams references, exposes the dangers both of contempt for the people and of short-sighted majority tyranny. In fact, Shakespeare's acuity about politics has given rise to a whole new field of scholarship in the past half century among students of political philosophy. But just as it's difficult to prove the direct influence of Homer on Greek constitutions or of Dante on Italian politics, so it's difficult to trace any direct line from poetry to law. Percy Bysshe Shelley's famous conclusion to his defense of poetry, asserting that poets are the unacknowledged legislators of mankind, holds true both for these earlier poets and for Shakespeare's deep influence in mapping the American terrain of power and ambition. James Shapiro points out in his introduction to Shakespeare in America in the Library of America series that there were probably fewer than 500 productions of Shakespeare's plays in the whole pre-revolutionary era. A huge difference from what would follow in the next century when Shakespeare was everywhere. The 19th century was unquestionably the great age of the bard in our country. After Alexis de Tocqueville visited America in 1831, he wrote that there is hardly a pioneer's hut that doesn't contain a few odd volumes of Shakespeare. I remember that I read the feudal drama of Henry V for the first time in a log cabin. So this is Tocqueville somewhere, right, in the backwoods. In the larger cities of the East, New York, Boston, Philadelphia, Washington, D.C., famous actors, American and British, performed Shakespeare's plays for large and enthusiastic audiences. As early as 1821, A young British genius named Junius Brutus Booth, a rival of the great Edward Kean in London, immigrated from England to America with his mistress, this is a long story, with his mistress Marianne Holmes, and earned acclaim everywhere he performed. Actors like Booth toured the new nation, and their interpretations of such favorite Shakespeare plays as Hamlet, Richard III, Othello, Macbeth, and Romeo and Juliet worked their way more and more deeply into the American imagination. In an essay written at mid-century when he was writing Moby Dick, Herman Melville makes a sharp distinction between the Shakespeare of discerning readers and the one who had a mere mob renown, like that, with the common people because of, quote, all the popularizing noise and show of broad farce and blood-smeared tragedy. Later in the 19th century, Mark Twain shows us what this mere mob Shakespeare must have looked like out on the frontier. The so-called Duke and Huckleberry Finn dreams up a theatrical scam to make money. And as he rehearses it on Huck's raft, the Duke strikes a most noble attitude, with one leg shoved forwards and his arms stretched away up, and his head tilted back, looking up at the sky. And then he begins to rip and rave and grit his teeth. And after that, all through his speech, he howled and spread around and swelled up his chest and just knocked the spots out of any acting ever I see before. This is the speech. I learned it easy enough while he was learning it to the king. To be or not to be. That is the bare bodkin that makes calamity of so long life. For who would fardels bear till Burnham Wood do come to Dunsinane? But that the fear of something after death murders the innocent sleep, great nature's second course, and makes us rather sling the arrows of outrageous fortune than fly to others that we know not of. So Twain's readers in 1885 instantly knew what a hilarious botch the Duke was making of Hamlet and Macbeth. I'm not sure a contemporary American audience would know the difference. Still, as Melville writes, it's the least part of genius that attracts admiration. And so much of the blind, unbridled admiration that has been heaped upon Shakespeare, this is Melville, has been lavished upon the least part of him. The part of Shakespeare that Melville most admires is a depth of metaphysical suggestion in the tragedies, a blackness of darkness that Shakespeare shares with Nathaniel Hawthorne. The playwright, says Melville, sometimes insinuates the things which we feel to be so terrifically true that it were all but madness for any good man in his own proper character to utter or even hint of them. Now, Melville was by no means alone in picking up these intuitions. The great actors of the time did. Moreover, the most consequential reader of Shakespeare in American history, the climactic figure of Shakespeare's intersection with America in our most Shakespearean century, certainly agreed with Melville about what was terrifically true in the tragedies. Abraham Lincoln brings the American engagement with Shakespeare into its most profound and paradoxical form. Like Shakespeare, Lincoln had no university education to ease his way in the world. But even as a boy, writes the historian Douglas Wilson, Lincoln knew he was unusually gifted and had great potential. Another biographer says that he carried away from his brief schooling the self-confidence of a man who has never met his intellectual equal. I think you have to say that about Shakespeare growing up in Stratford also, right? From the time he was a boy, Doris Kearns Goodwin writes, Lincoln followed the English kings into battle with Shakespeare. As he explored the wonders of literature and the history of the country, the young Lincoln, already conscious of his own power, developed ambitions far beyond the expectations of his family and friends. Just how far beyond might still surprise us. Shakespeare helped to form Lincoln's ambition, both to give it impetus and to warn him against where it might lead. In his Lyceum address, a speech that he gave in 1838 when he was 29 years old, Lincoln pulls back the curtain for a moment to reveal what American ambitions might look like. He speaks of the founding generation and the deeds that won its members lasting fame. And he wonders what follows now for those whose ambitions are as great as theirs. Quote, "It is to deny what the history of the world tells us is true, to suppose that men of ambition and talents will not continue to spring up amongst us. And when they do, they will as naturally seek the gratification of their ruling passion as others have done before them." He goes on to ask what to do with such a passion in the fledgling republic. Can that gratification be found in supporting and maintaining an edifice that has been erected by others? Most certainly it cannot. So the edifice he's talking about here means the established order of constitutional offices. Lincoln distinguishes between the ordinary man who would be satisfied with these, and in other words, he's talking about satisfied with, say, merely being president, right? And the geniuses who would not. So here's Lincoln from the Lyceum address. "Many great and good men, sufficiently qualified for any task they should undertake, may ever be found, whose ambition would inspire to nothing beyond a seat in Congress, a gubernatorial, or a presidential chair. But such belong not to the family of the lion or the tribe of the eagle." What? Think you these places would satisfy an Alexander, a Caesar, or Napoleon? Never. Towering genius disdains a beaten path. It seeks regions hitherto unexplored. It sees no distinction in adding story to story upon the monuments of fame erected to the memory of others. It denies that it is glory enough to serve under any chief. It scorns to tread in the footsteps of any predecessor, however illustrious. It thirsts and burns for distinction, and if possible, it will have it, whether at the expense of emancipating slaves or enslaving free men. Now, Lincoln goes on to ask, is it unreasonable then to expect that some man possessed of the fullest, loftiest genius, coupled with ambition sufficient to push it to its utmost stretch, will it sometimes spring up among us? It will require great attachment to the laws, he says, to restrain such a man. Distinction will be his paramount object. And although he would as willingly, perhaps more so, acquire it by doing good as harm, yet that opportunity being passed and nothing left to be done in the way of building up, he would set boldly to the task of pulling down. Now, it's always disconcerting, not just for me, I think for anybody who reads this speech, knowing Lincoln's history, when you look back at this from Lincoln's later career, to find that the man who emancipated the slaves is here speaking of the thirst for distinction. Despite his lifelong attachment to the laws, including his decades of practice in Illinois, I suggest that Lincoln understands this towering genius as few other men could. In fact, this whole meditation on the family of the lion or the tribe of the eagle could not come from a man of modest aspirations. As the American critic Edmund Wilson has written in Patriotic Gore, which is a wonderful book on the writings of the Civil War, he says, "It is evident that Lincoln has projected himself into the role against which he is warning them." Harry Jaffa, who has a wonderful book called The Crisis of the House Divided, agrees, but he argues that Lincoln would never be the Caesar whose ambition destroys the Republic, but an even greater figure, the savior of the Republic, the anti-Caesar. In any case, the young Lincoln was extremely ambitious, as Wilson says. He had great gifts, and the great distinction that history has since accorded him, a place higher than any American president besides George Washington, did not come unsought. William H. Herndon, his law partner, said of Lincoln after his death, "That man who thinks Lincoln calmly gathered his robes about him, waiting for the people to call him, has a very erroneous knowledge of Lincoln. He was always calculating and planning ahead. His ambition was a little engine that knew no rest." In other words, Lincoln was by no means one of those reluctant rulers who have to be virtually forced into office. Shakespeare, too, has reluctant rulers. Prospero, for example, who prefers his books and who disastrously leaves the daily management of Milan to his brother. But figures like Prospero were not the ones that preoccupied Lincoln. Rather, his favorites reveal his mindfulness of the dark side of ambition. Othello, for example. And when one of his staff went to see it with him, this man was struck by, quote, "the keen interest with which he followed the development of Iago's subtle treachery." Lincoln insisted on talking to the Iago performer between acts with, quote, "a very near approach to excitement," unquote. It was apparently disconcerting to see. One would have thought, the secretary said, that such a character would have had few points of attraction for a man to whose nature all its peculiar traits were so utterly foreign. Perhaps he was fascinated by the contrast. But the interest is consistent. Lincoln's fascination with the blackness of darkness shows through the plays and speeches that virtually obsessed him. Lincoln's private secretary, John Hay, recounts a time when Lincoln read him the end of Henry VI, Part 3, and the beginning of Richard III, relenting only when the young man started falling asleep. This was no random choice. In the last part of Henry VI, Part 3, Richard defines himself as the same kind of deceptive villain as Iago. "Why, I can smile and murder whiles I smile, and cry content to that which grieves my heart, and wet my cheeks with artificial tears, and frame my face to all occasions. I'll play the orator as well as Nestor, deceive more slyly than Ulysses could, and like a Sinon take another Troy. I can add colors to the chameleon, change shapes with Proteus for advantages, and set the murderous Machiavel to school. Can I do this and cannot get a crown?" Now, actors love this role. I mean, I think it's probably one of the reasons why Richard III is one of the more popular plays in, you know, early America. Because, you know, it gives the actor such a range in displaying his craft. But why does Lincoln love it? After Lincoln's closing argument in the Quinn Harrison trial in the summer of 1859, the opposing lawyer, John Palmer, accused Lincoln of believing nothing he said, but of feigning emotion to sway the jury. In fact, explicitly, of being an actor. Lincoln made his old acquaintance withdraw the accusation on the spot. They were old friends, and John Palmer was certainly kind of stepping outside the bounds there. Still, Lincoln returns often to the opening soliloquy of Richard III. In the previous play, Henry VI has just died at Richard's hand, and Edward of York, Richard's older brother, has just ascended the throne to general rejoicing. In his soliloquy, the hunchbacked, if you know this play, you know, at the end of Henry VI, there's a kind of exchange between the dying Henry VI and Duke of Gloucester, and Richard is the Duke who's later going to become Richard III. But Henry VI taunts him with having teeth when he was born. You know, his own mother didn't love him. You know, it was just sort of a horrible way to be greeted into the world. But in any case, here the hunchback and limping Richard explains how in the glorious summer of King Edward's new reign, grim-visaged war now capers nimbly in a lady's chamber to the lascivious pleasing of a lute. Richard, by contrast, feels his own unsuitability for the lover's role, and his very ugliness begins to draw the audience into an uneasy sympathy. If you see Richard acted well, this is exactly what you're seeing. You know, he's limping around the stage, and the kind of way he confides in you pulls you into the part. But I'm not shaped for sportive tricks, nor made to court an amorous looking glass, I that am rudely stamped and want love's majesty to strut before a wanton ambling nymph, I that am curtailed of this fair proportion, cheated of feature by dissembling nature, deformed, unfinished, sent before my time into this breathing world, scarce half made up, and that so lamely and unfashionable that dogs bark at me as I halt by them. Why, I, in this weak peeping time of peace, have no delight to pass away the time, except to spy my shadow in the sun and descant on mine own deformity. And therefore, since I cannot prove a lover to entertain these fair, well-spoken days, I am determined to prove a villain and hate the idle pleasures of these days. So nature, in the way that Richard is imagining it, dissembling nature, gave him an outer appearance and a place in the order of birth, thoroughly at odds with his intelligence, his courage, and his ambition to be king. The mordant humor of his self-description doesn't hide his bitterness. Lincoln sometimes quoted Richard's lines in referring to his own ugliness, even claimed that dogs barked at him. I don't know. His friend Ward Hill Lehman described him as over 6 feet 4 inches in height, his legs out of all proportion to his body. His head was long and tall from the base of the brain to the eyebrows. His ears were large, his nose long and blunt, the tip of it rather ruddy and slightly awry toward the right-hand side. His chin projecting far and sharp, curved upward to meet a thick lower lip which hung downward, and so on. In a book about Lincoln's Cooper Union speech in New York City, Harold Holzer has a whole chapter about how hard the famous photographer Matthew Brady had to work to dignify Lincoln's homely looks in an iconic photograph from 1860. Apparently, he had to pull the collar way up, and it took him a couple of hours to get this picture ready. In any case, the artist Francis Bicknell Carpenter, who painted official portraits of Lincoln and his family, obviously had some of the same challenges as Brady. Now, it's from Carpenter, who later wrote a book called 6 Months in the White House, that we get the most fascinating glimpse of Lincoln's absorption with Richard III. Lincoln told Carpenter, "The opening of the play of King Richard III seems to me often entirely misapprehended. It's quite common for an actor to come upon the stage and in a sophomoric style to begin with a flourish. Now is the winter of our discontent made glorious summer by this son of York, and all the clouds that lowered upon our house in the deep bosom of the ocean buried." I hope that was sophomoric enough for you. "Now," said Lincoln to Carpenter, "this is all wrong. Richard, you remember, Saul Lincoln, had been and was then plotting the destruction of his brothers to make room for himself. Outwardly the most loyal to the newly crowned king, secretly he could scarcely contain his impatience at the obstacle still in the way of his own elevation. He appears upon the stage just after the crowning of Edward, burning with repressed hate and jealousy. The prologue is the utterance of the most intense bitterness and satire." Now that's all Lincoln, right, describing Richard III in this opening soliloquy. Now this is Carpenter. "Unconsciously assuming the character, Mr. Lincoln repeated from memory Richard's soliloquy, rendering it with a degree of force and power that made it seem like a new creation to me. Though familiar with the passage from boyhood, I can truly say that never till that moment had I fully appreciated its spirit. I could not refrain from laying down my palette and brushes and applauding heartily upon his conclusion, saying at the same time, half in earnest, that I was not sure but that he had made a mistake in the choice of a profession, considerably as may be imagined to his amusement. Mr. Samuel Sinclair of the New York Tribune has since repeatedly said to me that he never heard this choice passage of Shakespeare rendered with more effect by the most famous of modern actors. I doubt that we should treat Carpenter's quotations from Lincoln as verbatim transcripts. In fact, they sound like reconstructions after the fact. But I see no reason to doubt the veracity of the opinions expressed. What interests me here is not only how Lincoln interprets the speech, but also how the speech interprets Lincoln, how he unconsciously assumes the character, that is, gives voice to the most intense bitterness and satire, burning with repressed hate and jealousy, his own words. Lincoln reveals his understanding of what the actor in this famous popular role most needs to convey, and he draws upon his own capacities to convey it. Is there another American president we can even imagine doing such a thing? Despite his rebuke of John Palmer in the Quinn Harrison trial, Lincoln felt at home among actors. He befriended a number of them, and among these Shakespearean peers, so to speak, his favorite was James Hackett, whose performance of Falstaff he greatly admired. In a letter to Hackett, this was the letter that Hackett published without Lincoln's permission, by the way, and you know, Lincoln got mocked for some of the opinions he expresses in it, I think unfairly. In any case, here's what Lincoln wrote to Hackett. Some of Shakespeare's plays I've never read, while others I've gone over perhaps as frequently as any unprofessional reader. Among the latter are Lear, Richard III, Henry VIII, Hamlet, and especially Macbeth. I think none equals Macbeth. It's wonderful. Unlike you gentlemen of the profession, I think the soliloquy in Hamlet commencing, "Oh, my offense is rank," surpasses that commencing, "To be or not to be." But pardon this small attempt at criticism. I should like to hear you pronounce the opening speech of Richard III. This to Hackett, right? So I don't think Hackett would have suspected what kind of rival he had in Lincoln. As it happens, the most famous actor of the age, much more famous than Hackett, was Edwin Booth, son of Junius Brutus Booth. Noah Brooks, a friend of Lincoln's during his years in the White House, writes that he accompanied Lincoln to see Booth, probably as Shylock, in a production of The Merchant of Venice at Ford's Theater. But Hamlet was Booth's favorite role, and he had recently performed it in New York City 100 nights in a row to great acclaim. John Barrymore, you know, the famous actor early in the 20th century, did it 101 times in a row just to, you know, outdo Edwin Booth. But in any case, in an essay shortly after Edwin Booth's death in 1893, the critic William Winter remembered Booth's Hamlet. He says, "The rejection of all singularity and the avoidance of all meretricious ornament resulted in a sturdy artistic honesty which could not be too much admired. His Hamlet had the terrible reality of suffering. There was no realism in it, no fantastic stage business, no labored strangeness of new readings. It was the presentment of the spiritual state of a gifted man whom nature and circumstance have made so clear-sighted and yet so wretchedly dubious that his surroundings overwhelm him and life becomes to him a burden and a curse. Hamlet is a mystery, but seeing that personation, the thinker saw what Shakespeare meant." You know, this 30 years after Lincoln saw, you know, Booth in the same role. The most famous, probably, acting, you know, sequence of acting performances in the 19th century. In his memoir, Carpenter remembered that Edwin Booth had been playing an engagement at Grover's Theater in Washington when he and Lincoln first started talking about Shakespeare. This is Carpenter. "He had been announced for the coming evening in his famous part of Hamlet. The president had never witnessed his representation of this character, and he proposed being present. The mention of this play, which I afterward learned, had at all times a peculiar charm for Mr. Lincoln's mind, waked up a train of thought I was not prepared for. Said he, and his words have often returned to me with a sad interest since his own assassination. This is Lincoln. There is one passage of the play of Hamlet which is very apt to be slurred over by the actor or omitted altogether, which seems to me the choicest part of the play. It is the soliloquy of the king after the murder. It always struck me as one of the finest touches of nature in the world. As with Richard III's opening soliloquy, Lincoln recited this entire passage from memory with a feeling and appreciation unsurpassed by anything I ever witnessed upon the stage, Carpenter writes. Here's the soliloquy. Oh, my offense is rank. It smells to heaven. It hath the primal eldest curse upon it, a brother's murder. Pray, can I not, though inclination be as sharp as will? My stronger guilt defeats my strong intent. And like a man to double business bound, I stand in pause where I shall first begin and both neglect. But oh, what form of prayer can serve my turn? Forgive me my foul murder? That cannot be, since I am still possessed of those effects for which I did the murder, my crown, mine own ambition, and my queen. May one be pardoned and retain the offense? In the corrupted currents of this world, offense's gilded hand may shove by justice, and oft 'tis seen the wicked prize itself buys out the law. But 'tis not so above. There is no shuffling. There the action lies in his true nature, and we ourselves compelled even to the teeth and forehead of our faults to give in evidence. What then? What rest? Try what repentance can. What can it not? Yet what can it when one cannot repent? O wretched state, O bosom black as death, O limed soul that struggling to be free art more engaged, help angels, make assay. Bow stubborn knees, and heart with strings of steel, be soft as sinews of the newborn babe. All may be well. Now, David Herbert Donnell remarks in his biography of Lincoln that this speech was included in William Scott's Lessons in Elocution, a book that Lincoln had from his stepmother as a boy. This is Donald. Among the set pieces it included was King Claudius' speech on his murder of Hamlet's father. Oh, my offense is rank, it smells to heaven. It remained one of Lincoln's favorite passages. But there were 14 other speeches by Shakespeare in that volume, including Mark Antony's speech over the body of Caesar, Henry V's St. Crispin's Day speech. The fact that Claudius' speech appeals to Lincoln more than To Be or Not to Be, even performed by Edwin Booth, makes sense in the same context as the ambitious Macbeth soliloquies after the murder of Duncan. David Bromwich writes, Lincoln was deeply touched by the portrait of a politician who had committed great wrongs. He was not equally moved by the thoughts of a hero who reproached himself for doing too little. Lincoln could never be accused of doing too little. Just to step back for a moment from Shakespeare. As a trial lawyer, his closing arguments, which could be full of pathos, were as famously effective with juries as his logical arguments were with judges. On the national level, he was a powerful interpreter of the Constitution and the intention of the founders. Whether slavery would be allowed in the new territories was the great question in the 1850s. And Lincoln's persuasiveness as an opponent of Stephen Douglas's popular sovereignty brought him from obscurity in Illinois to the Republican nomination for president in 1860. The Cooper Union speech early in 1860 addressed the South in a series of questions almost guaranteed to rouse Southern sentiment against him. He won the election that November with less than 40% of the popular vote, and his victory in the Electoral College prompted the secession of the Southern states and the formation of the Confederacy. After the attack on Fort Sumter in April of 1861, Lincoln called for troops and sent them against the states whose right to secede from the Union he denied. And the war began in earnest with the First Battle of Manassas in July of that year. The Civil War was unquestionably the greatest crisis of our history. Comparable to the civil wars of Rome between Caesar and the defenders of the Republic, it far exceeded in devastation the War of the Roses. An estimated 620,000 men died, more than the total number of dead in all other American wars, including the two World Wars and the Korean War, until Vietnam added enough mortalities to pass it. Lincoln was at the center of it, and Shakespeare was his recourse throughout this protracted crisis, as many witnesses attest. The plays give language to those depths in Lincoln that he could never say or even hint at in his own proper character, as Melville puts it. It would be disingenuous to pretend that Lincoln's Shakespearean preferences tell us nothing about him. He feels the quandaries of Claudius or Macbeth more deeply than the rhetorically charged dilemmas of Hamlet. Why? Because he somehow understands what it feels like to want to repent and yet not to be able to give up the rewards for which he committed the offense. He feels very keenly the approach of a judgment where the action lies in his true nature, and we ourselves compelled even to the teeth and forehead of our faults to give in evidence. He feels this judgment on the nation in the second inaugural. If you remember this passage, if we shall suppose that American slavery is one of those offenses which in the providence of God must needs come, but which having continued through his appointed time, he now wills to remove, and that he gives to both North and South this terrible war as the woe due to those by whom the offense came. Shall we discern therein any departure from those divine attributes which the believers in a living God always ascribe to him? Or does Lincoln feel a guilt of his own as well? Lincoln believed, earnestly, deeply believed, that the South had insisted on war. But he had to see himself as a cause, to be sure a principled cause, of immense suffering in defending the Union. In war, the whole aim is to win. And in winning the war, he did what was expedient with respect to the Constitution, not that he planned it at the outset. What began in 1861 as a war to restore the Union became by 1863, with the Emancipation Proclamation, a war to emancipate the slaves. And as this holy war escalated, he watched the North demonize the people of the Confederacy, most of whom, 67%, had never owned slaves. He encouraged Sherman and Sheridan to wage war on civilian populations in a way that would make restored Union the rule of a victorious nation over a subjugated and embittered one, not a matter of the consent of the governed. No man with Lincoln's depth of soul could fail to be conscious of his own part in the divide between the first American order and the very different Union that would emerge from the Civil War. Neither could he fail to be conscious of an almost divinizing glory attaching to him as Father Abraham, the great emancipator. This was a distinction he could never have achieved in a weak, piping time of peace, as Richard III puts it, or the mild season of peace when the Constitution itself was framed. He could not repent of the outcome. The nation reunited, slavery abolished, himself immortalized. Yet somewhere in Claudius, he sees his own dilemma. He does not exult over his gains. Nowhere do we sense in Lincoln the unassailable self-righteousness that one can find in the abolitionist William Lloyd Garrison, who condemned Southern slaveholders as possessed by demons. On July 4, 1854, in Framingham, Massachusetts, Garrison publicly burned a copy of the Constitution and described it as a covenant with death, an agreement with hell, because of its compromise with slavery. From Lincoln, Instead of such preachments of moral superiority, we get the soliloquies of Richard III and Claudius. We get fascination with Iago and praise for Macbeth, that tragedy about a villain of unbridled ambition with an even more ambitious wife urging him on. I just discovered that Bill Clinton also liked Macbeth. Lincoln seems drawn to contemplate a particular kind of scheming, chameleonic, ambitious character. Perhaps it comes from his close scrutiny of human nature as a lawyer. But where is his interest in Henry V, who goes in disguise among the soldiers at Agincourt at night, or the noble Kent in King Lear, or the fiercely proud Coriolanus, who cannot bring himself to feign a humble respect for the common people? I will not do it, lest I surcease to honor mine own truth and by my body's action teach my mind a most inherent baseness. Rather than play a part like an actor, Coriolanus forfeits his chance to be consul and turns against his own city. Lincoln, by contrast, has no such scruples. He follows Shakespeare deep into the inner dynamics of villainy. He does not stand outside a villainous character merely to condemn him, but enters in, finding the man's own inner justification and distinctive voice, and giving his own voice to its expression. As an actor, he can uncover the darkness he knows, and yet do so in a way that makes it a performance, a made persona, different from what he is in his own nature. He can objectify an inner possibility and displace it onto a character, as Shakespeare does in writing the part and as an actor does on the stage. In private, in his brilliantly dark soliloquies before the man charged with painting his portrait, Lincoln revealed that he could in fact have been the greatest actor of his age. In one sense, that assessment's already a Shakespearean truism, all the world's a stage, another speech to be found, by the way, in Lessons in Elocution. After the French Revolution, there was no greater world stage for ambition than the American Civil War, and there was no greater backdrop for the irony and tragedy of Lincoln's assassination than Lee's surrender at Appomattox only 5 days earlier. But the stage in Lincoln's case has an even more literal meaning, since he was shot in Ford's Theater at the performance of a popular play called Our American Cousin, starring the famous actress Laura Keene. A decade earlier, Laura Keene had been Edwin Booth's lover. In fact, Edwin Booth, the man who redefined Shakespearean performance in the Shakespearean 19th century, unquestionably the most celebrated actor of his time, was so deeply embedded in the meaning of Lincoln's assassination that Lincoln almost becomes his double, his substitute, and not the other way around. Booth's younger brother, John Wilkes Booth, also an actor, had very little talent. He wrecked more than one performance by forgetting his lines. When he did remember, he ranted like the Duke on Huck Finn's raft. But he was handsome enough to make a certain class of women swarm around him wherever he went, and his natural athleticism let him excel at leaping or at sword fighting scenes, though he often injured his fellow actors in his raging enthusiasm. Trading on his father's famous name, Wilkes, as he was known, performed in venues across the country, including stints in Washington, D.C., where Lincoln saw him at least once. But Wilkes had little success. Next to Edwin, he was nothing. As the historian Nora Totone, this is a fascinating book. It's called My Thoughts Be Bloody. It's a chronicle of the Booth family. She shows that Wilkes Booth increasingly identified his high-handed older brother with Lincoln and the Union cause, while John Wilkes Booth, you know, tended more and more toward the South. But John Wilkes Booth seems almost to have been summoned out of obscurity just to be the anti-Lincoln, this handsome man with no talent who burned and thirsted for distinction out of his consciousness of inferiority instead of his sense of towering genius. Already in 1862, drinking one afternoon in Chicago, John Wilkes Booth was heard to say, "What a glorious opportunity there is for a man to immortalize himself by killing Lincoln." By 1864, he was caught up in a plot to do it, and on April 14, 1865, he entered Lincoln's private box at the Ford Theater and shot Lincoln in the head. Then he leapt down to the stage with his usual athleticism and shouted to the audience, "Sic semper tyrannis," thus always to tyrants. In his own estimation, he had just assassinated a Caesar or a Napoleon. He thought he would be honored for it, just as Brutus and Cassius thought they would be honored for ages to come. Remember his father's name, you know, Junius Brutus Booth. If you remember Brutus and Cassius dipping their hands in Caesar's blood, at that very moment, they're already thinking about it being enacted, you know, in plays and centuries to come. Everything about the scene and its aftermath feels somehow Shakespearean. It's as though the hunchbacked, chameleonic villain that Lincoln had understood so well had coalesced in this resentful actor. John Wilkes Booth had actually played Richard III on occasion, badly. Now he literally limped off the stage after injuring his leg. Laura Keene, who had played so many Shakespearean heroines, held Lincoln's bleeding head in her lap. Killing Lincoln immortalized John Wilkes Booth and erased his brother, who almost literally died in the first shame of it. You know, you're the most famous actor in America, great supporter of the Union cause, and your brother shoots Lincoln, you know. Nora Tittone shows in detail how Edwin recovered his career and dominated the American stage for three more decades. But few in our century know even the name of Edwin, whereas everyone knows John Wilkes Booth. This was the same kind of murderous usurpation that Lincoln brooded on so profoundly. Killing Lincoln was the means for an envious brother to steal from posterity the fame of the greatest actor of the age. Ironically, and the ironies go far beyond anything I have time to explore, the very murder that erased Edwin secured the undying glory of Abraham Lincoln. The assassination cast out forever the shadow of Lincoln's supreme ambition by making him die the death of a Caesar without deserving it. Instead of becoming a Brutus, John Wilkes Booth absorbed forever the figure of the scheming usurper and ceded the role of noble victim to Lincoln. But above all, John Wilkes Booth made Lincoln Shakespearean in the very staging of his death. In all of Shakespeare, only the death of Lear approaches Lincoln's in high tragic pathos. To my mind, only Shakespeare can prepare us to understand the whole truth of this man who burned for distinction as a young man and who achieved a distinction unique in our national history.